This afternoon, I'd like to give you a little bit of my background and some information about the Kansas Project. I won't go into it in a lot of detail, but to try to give you some information so that as we move into some of the challenges with telemedicine and some of the issues that we've dealt with in the state, the same types of issues I think you all will be dealing with in your practices, you'll understand a little bit more about my own personal perspective. And before we jump too much further, how many of you are involved in active telemedicine projects at this time? And are these projects interactive video type projects? Are they store and forward? What are you working now? Interactive for the most part. And the rest of you, how many are you going to start a project or in the process of pulling together all that for? I see. There are different schools of thought about this. It seems as though, even though telemedicine is anything from a telephone call all the way up to interactive video, as defined by some people in the telemedicine world, it seems like, as clinicians, we tend to think of the interactive video as being telemedicine, and seeing patients, assessing and diagnosing over a system is telemedicine. There is a group of individuals out there that believe telemedicine is the whole gamut. Telephone call, fax machine, interactive video, virtual surgery, all of that fits into the broad category of telemedicine. Some of my perspective really comes from the definition of telemedicine as a project in which patients are actually seen over the system. So for that background, we'll use the tele-oncology practice to explain what I'm talking about when we talk about telemedicine practice. And I'd like to jump into some of the challenges that we faced in Kansas and challenges that I think have been recognized on the national level as well. Kansas is a large state. It sits right in the heart of the country, as most of you know. We have a very large rural population. It takes about 8.5 hours to drive across the state of Kansas to Colorado, and most people in Missouri know that because when they want to go skiing, they drive across the state of Kansas, but they don't stop anywhere. They just go right through to try to get to the Colorado Rockies and beautiful country and wonderful skiing. It is a long drive. We have 105 counties, and we have a physician shortage and have had, really, in the last 3 decades. 2/3 of our Kansas counties are underserved for primary care. So if we're talking about trying to reach these areas for subspecialty care, we have to keep in mind that we also are dealing with a primary care physician shortage, primary care practitioner shortage in these sites. There are a variety of reasons that have been promoted as being the cause for this shortage, anything from geographic isolation and the fact that it takes you so long to drive from these sites to an urban area. I would tell you, I think professional isolation is key. It is hard to practice medicine on the front lines. It is hard to practice medicine in a rural community when your training was in an urban center. So there are many factors that come into it. We look to telemedicine to try to help us with this geographic isolation in Kansas and certainly the professional isolation issues that we grapple with. And Kansas, like every other state and like the country at large, grappling with healthcare costs that are ever expanding and hoped that telemedicine would help with some of the rising healthcare costs and more in a cost containment manner, as was discussed the day before yesterday, rather than actually bringing costs down. We've looked at telemedicine to provide patient services. Again, we've got sparsely populated areas. I'll throw another figure for you. 1/3 of our Kansas counties have less than 10 persons per square mile, and that is the cutoff for federal designation as frontier. So 1/3 of our Kansas counties are federally designated frontier areas. Those patients want access to subspecialty care. Those patients want access to information about their disease processes, and they don't really want to drive 6 hours to an urban site to get it. We've looked to the system to provide patient consultative services. We've also looked to provide direct patient education services by interactive video. And certainly provider education, and I've listed that last, but for most of you that are starting projects, I'm sure you'll recognize that continuing medical education courses over a system, it's natural, it's interactive. You can provide it to a physician or a nurse practitioner's office during the lunch hour so they can finish with their patients in the morning, go to their CME class, and still get back to a full patient load in the afternoon. This is how so many projects get launched. It is a cost-effective way of delivering educational services. In Kansas, we fly physicians to different sites in the state to deliver CME addresses. So we'll fly somebody to Hayes. It costs us $900 to use the state plane to do that. They'll give a lecture for an hour and get on the plane and go back. So not only are we incurring the plane expense, but we're also tying a physician's time up for 5 to 6 hours when they too can go down to the interactive video suite for an hour lecture and go across the hall and see patients again. It makes perfect sense for educational purposes, and again, this is how many projects were able to justify the initial capital outlay to get started. This is not a fast process. For those of you that are starting, I mean, our proposal was made in 1988. The Kansas lore is a pediatrician from Hayes, located about 5 hours to the west of Kansas City by car, was frustrated and tired and had been on call night after night after night and came to the medical center saying, is there anything that we can do about this? Or is there any way to arrange call coverage? Can we do this by locum? Can we do it by phone? What about interactive video and call coverage? And at that time, the director of information technology at KU knew of interactive video services, in fact, remembered the original telemedicine projects over time and thought this would be something that we ought to at least look at. Okay, but from the time the original proposal was made until we were operational, we're looking at a 3-year period. We had to grapple with some telecom infrastructure issues that certainly the state of Vermont is not grappling with. I'm very impressed with their state telecom infrastructure. And this had to be worked out before we could establish our first link. Our first link was between the Medical Center campus in Kansas City, the far eastern part of the state, linking to the Area Health Education Center in Hayes, again, 280 miles west. There was some clinical activity in late 91 and 92, but things didn't really take off until 93. And then in 95, when I came on board, that was at a point where we decided to formalize and centralize the administrative network for the telemedicine project. I need to show this group the room system. I put this slide in to remind myself that when I speak about telemedicine and some of the biases that you will hear come from an interactive video bent, from a direct patient care bent, not from the web-based telemedicine, phone consultative services, all of those things that as you read, are considered part of telemedicine practice today.
What is that? It's a cable.
We actually, have any of you worked with cable-based systems at all? There's a company out of Lawrence, Kansas that was very interested in using cable to provide home-based services. And I think the company's probably about 4 years old now, which is, I guess, old by telemedicine standards. They had a unit in which they harnessed cable technology and had it so that two-way interactive video could occur. It's great. It's real time. It looks like your satellite or full T1 or broadcast quality video. The problem with it is you have to work with the cable companies, and you have to have a cable company that's cooperative. It has been such a frustration that company no longer even works in the cable arena, but is switched primarily to POTS-based or ISDN units. ISDN. That's what I meant. You for a room-based system like that, we run it a quarter T1 or 384, but it goes from that up to full T1 or again, to give you some idea of distance and what we grapple with in the state, our first connection was from the eastern part of the state where the medical center is located to the western part of the state. At the present time, we have 25 active sites that have come on board. We are a little bit different in that our project kind of grew from the outer part of the state inward. And by that, I mean each one of these sites was responsible for funding their own units, for funding their own telecom connection, whatever. They took that on to connect with the Kansan backbone and to connect with KU Medical Center. Now this is, for those of us that are at a site like KU, it has worked very well. I guess I would like to tell you that we had $6 million and a $7 million grant to fund all of these sites and to put these things up. And in fact, that would have been nice. The reverse is we didn't have that, and these sites managed either through grants, through very innovative ways to fund their local projects and to connect with the system. And as a result, not only did they buy in, with regard to the infrastructure, they also bought in regard to the concept. When they bought those units, they wanted to use them. When they bought those units, they had a specific need that they were trying to address. And I think that actually has served us well over the last few years. And I think that might be a little bit different than a hub purchasing the units and setting them outside. What about activity? And I use KU as an example because I think it's actually pretty typical for most projects. And for those of you that start, I would encourage you not to be discouraged by your level of activity to begin with. It seems like every project that is reported, there's this lull of 2 or 3 years. And I think there are a variety of reasons why we have this lull in clinical activity. Anything from just getting your infrastructure in place, which I do think is important, but probably even more important is establishing the relationships between the different hospitals and the different people that are providing the services, the different people, in our case, in the state, that want access and want to use the service. It's not about technology. It's about people. It's not about tele. It's about practicing medicine. And through that time period, I think we were working hard just to form those relationships, to formalize the practice patterns more, and to work with clinicians that had specific needs. So we noticed a very big change between, actually even between 93 and 94, there was a ramp up. But in 96, clearly our level of activity was different. The other thing that happened between 94 and 96 was the establishment of dedicated clinics. We had dedicated oncology, psychiatry, adult and child clinics that came on board, and more recently rheumatology and cardiology. And obviously these are clinics that meet once a month, and so the level of activity, I beg your pardon, once a week, and so the level of activity has changed tremendously. Also during 94 and 95, we began to offer monthly clinics that were slated, scheduled, promoted, if you will, to practitioners in the state if you need a second opinion consult for cancer services, if you need a pulmonary consult, cardiology, or whatever. Every Tuesday from 2 to 5, there's a cardiologist that's available to do that. So we changed the way we offered the service a little bit. I have to tell you, those clinics have been well received, but not utilized that frequently. Okay, those that use it are real happy with it, but I wouldn't tell you that the level of activity has been particularly high offering a service like that.
When did 25 sites come on board? Does that affect your usage?
You know, we actually have maps for each year. I just didn't feel like I could do that to you. This is after lunch. It's bad enough as it is. In 91, it was that first connection. In 92, we had three more that came on board. And each year, between 3 and 5 have come on board through various mechanisms. One of our sites went to their local telecom people and said, buy us a unit. And the telecom people said, okay. So, and that was a $100,000 unit. That was in 92 when the expenses were really high for the room-based systems. Others, two of our sites, Syracuse and Lakin, put in a grant so that they could cross-cover each other's emergency rooms at night. Syracuse, those of you that have heard me already, you've heard this so many times, there's 800 people that live in Syracuse, Kansas. There are 1,200 people that live in Lakin. Two docs in one town, three in another. And they're constantly going to the ER at night to see sore throats and things that really aren't truly emergent. So they filed for and received a grant to cross-cover for each other, and that's how they funded their hardware. There are a variety of ways, different foundations in the state for different health-related projects have funded it. And then other hospitals have just gone out and purchased their own. We think this is important, we want to connect, and they put the capital outlay to see it happen. So it's been about 3 to 5 per year. I think that map is, we have a couple more that'll come on board. There are several projects right now that have the potential to roll out 20 to 30 units. So I think it's going to get to the point where we can't even show a map anymore. We'll reach a certain level in the state where it's just very easy to access and it won't take that long to get to a site. Well, you've all heard this needs-based talk. We've all heard the needs-based talk, and it is really important. I can't overemphasize taking a look at a specific need that you're trying to address. Well, who said it earlier this week? Telemedicine is a solution looking for a problem. Okay. Do not approach it that way. Your system will not be utilized. If you have a very clear, specific project that you have in mind, a very clear, specific need, then go find the technology and harness that technology for that specific need. The other thing is when you do your needs assessment, believe it. You know, we'll go to sites, we'll help them do a needs assessment, and we'll say, you know what, you don't need this big, expensive, bulky unit. You're not going to be doing video conferencing. You can really settle for a desktop unit that will give us the same video quality that we want. You'll still be running at 384. You can spend $8,000 here or $40,000 over here. And you've looked at your needs, and this fits your needs. They'll still buy the $40,000 unit because who knows what next year will bring. Maybe we'll want it next year. Maybe that's when, you know. We're afraid of underbuying right now, whatever that means. What is underbuying? I don't understand that. So if you do your needs assessment and you find a solution that is reasonable, accept your needs assessment and go with the solution. In Kansas, we had a very clear need for an oncologist in a particular community. Did I put in units and say, I'm an oncologist, come use me? No, I might have tried that if they would have let me at the time. It just so happened. That's not what I was asked to do. There was I mentioned Hayes before, a town 5 hours west of Kansas City. They had an oncologist that had been practicing there for a year. Before that time, colleagues of mine at the University of Kansas had conducted outreach clinics in Hayes. So we have this patient base already in place. Okay? Their oncologist leaves, they need an oncologist, but haven't been able to recruit one. Here, you know, Ace Allen and Gary Dew will fly out to Hayes and say, we'll try doing this, but we're going to do it with a combination of telemedicine clinics and on-site clinics. They said, fine. So in 1993, the first telemedicine clinical consults were conducted, and these were done by Ace Allen, an oncologist at KU, very interested and very active in telemedicine right now. But in 95 is when we started the dedicated clinic, the one that meets twice a week. I fly out there twice a month. Why did I fly out there twice a month? Because I was nervous as heck practicing medicine over the system. I wanted to see these people in person. I didn't believe that you could do this. And everyone that I talked to said, you can't practice medicine that way, you're going to get sued and everything else. So I wanted to see a patient over the system, but also know that there was some mechanism in place that I could go see them in person as well. And we've laughed about this. Some of the people I've talked to in this group already, it used to be that I would see a patient on Thursday. The telemedicine system said, maybe out Monday, can you come back and see me on Monday? You know, 4 days later, is this really necessary? It wasn't necessary for the patient, but it was necessary to treat the doctor. So I would see a patient on the telemedicine system, fly out there 4 days later, and after about, and it really didn't take that long. It's almost scary. It only took a month or two before I started to feel very comfortable with the system and feel like I was getting the type of information I needed to accurately assess. Keeping in mind that at that time, and even today, there are no good efficacy data out there to say this is a reasonable way to try to deliver this care. So I felt like we were kind of flapping out there, and I wanted to be able to see them in person to augment that. We were laughing this morning. At first, I considered the telemedicine a way to augment the outreach clinics. Now I consider the outreach clinics a way to augment what I do by telemedicine. It's shifted in my own mind the way we provide the service. In 96, we started offering some different things that support the oncology practice, including patient support services, the I Can Cope series we now offer for individual patients that go to these different sites in the state. We have a smoking cessation course, a pain management service that is offered for patients that have difficult pain syndromes with their cancer. And now more recently, the home-based services, particularly the hospice project that we talk about at the pod session. When you've all come, that's what I'm referring to. And for those that we meet tomorrow, the hospice people who do by plain old telephone service. Yes?
When you say you're offering these augmented services, are some of those remotely based? Are all of the ones you're talking about based in?
Patients are big. Oh, let me repeat the question. The question was the augmented services that we're doing for the oncology practice, where are we based? The providers are based still on the medical center campus. The patients can be at any one of the 24 sites. The largest patient base that I have is in Hayes, but I've seen consults for other communities. The providers from Kansas City will tie wherever they are. Some of the I Can Cope series were three sites up on board. It was a multi-point, so they could all participate at the same time and talk at the same time. That came out of a specific need. I had patients that I was seeing that didn't have a support group they could go to. The towns are so small. It just had never been pulled together. I have found that very gratifying because a couple of the sites that came on board continued the support service without us, continued the support group without us. So I'm hoping that as we launch some of these things that it will gain momentum and continue locally without us having to be the candidates from the medical center campus. We had encouraged different sites. The smoking cessation course, I'm an absolute fanatic about tobacco. I'm an oncologist. I mean, it goes together. So I wanted this course for patients, again, that I was seeing that didn't have this alternative. Well, interestingly, as we started to launch this, the Hayes group wanted to provide it locally, and so we're using their providers to shoot from Hayes to other areas. Okay, it doesn't have to emanate from the medical center campus. As a matter of fact, we like and encourage other sites to come on board and like to help them facilitate their service. Just to let you know that actually there's about 100 patients now. We're over 350 visits. See how technical I am. I am interested in efficacy. I'm very interested in cost and satisfaction studies. I've been trying to pull this together. Just a picture of the system. Let me back up. Editorial comment. This is not teleradiology, but this is great for a clinician. Okay, while this may not be considered diagnostic quality, and a radiologist may not want to diagnose from this, the image that I'm seeing is adequate. I have a radiologist interpretation that I can refer to, and I have something even better. I have a patient that I can talk to. I have a history that is valuable when you're trying to interpret film. So even though my plug for this slide is, even though this is not considered diagnostic quality, this is great. This really helps a clinician practice.
A little bit of subliminal messaging there, too, with your TU.
Yes, exactly. Just a Jayhawk for all of you. I know this is Vermont, okay?
Do they have a basketball team?
This is the home-based units that we have, the POTS units, produced by VIATD, or the 8x8 company. We launched a hospice project, and this is a very sophisticated workstation. Actually, believe it or not, I cleaned up my office for this picture. And that's not a hospice patient. That's actually my father-in-law. I've been real careful about photographing anybody that was a patient, so if you're wondering. The images are adequate. If you've been by the POTS station, you understand what I mean. The video quality isn't the same. Let's move on.
And are the POTS systems then used just to give people a better feel? I mean, it's just person-to-person contact? Is that
What I'm working with is a group of hospice patients, and we had some very specific things. We're dealing in a rural state, and even in the Kansas City area, we have people that we're trying to service that are quite some distance from our base hospice. We were using these units to try to help us with call and the visits that were being made after hours, and also to try to help us just troubleshoot simple problems, catheter-related problems, pain control issues that you think you don't have to make a visit, but when you have someone that's in a lot of pain, the whole hospice philosophy is to respond and to respond quickly. So we were using these units, or hoping to use these units, to respond quickly and try to determine if it's the situation one that I can manage by video phone, and do I actually need to make a visit. I really feel fortunate to be able to give a talk like this because it really is kind of an opinions-based talk, and that doesn't happen very often. Usually people are interrogating me about specifics of efficacy and that type of thing. And I want to qualify it, that you are really getting one person's opinion, not the world according to Garvin, but the world according to Gary. And you will all have your own experiences, and please feel free to shout at me or argue with me. This is the perspective of someone that works in a state system. I'm in an academic center. Our mission is to provide educational and clinical services to people in the state. I'm not in a health system, so to speak, and so I think that colors some of the opinions that I have about telemedicine. And so with that disclaimer, the other disclaimer is telemedicine is not going to solve every single medical problem in the country. But having said that, I'm a telemedicine enthusiast, and I think it's going to wildly change the way that we practice, and we'll go on. every project deals with particular challenges. We used to call them barriers, but it's 1997, so I like to use telemedicine challenges instead of barriers.
GAO still uses barriers.
Who does?
The General Accounting Office.
GAO still uses barriers, and you still see it in the literature like that. It's a similar list of issues that everyone deals with. We still deal with these at KU. These have not gone away in the last few years. We deal with medical culture issues. We deal with a problem in that telemedicine can disrupt referral patterns. We deal with a lack of telemedical research and the implication that has in adopting systems. We deal with liability, reimbursement, licensure, and technology-related issues. And I'm just going to talk about each one of these briefly. And I'll give you, okay, the medical community in Kansas has embraced telemedicine. It's a great new way to deliver quality medical care. I don't think so. And I I have to admit that things are very different in 1997 than what they were in 1991, but we still have a long way to go just in explaining what technology is and how it works. It is a different way of practicing medicine, and if you're a clinician, you know, it's very different than if you're a teleradiologist. I think teleradiologists will tell you, I'm doing what I always do. Teleradiology is great. It's a glorified FedEx system. I get the films to read in a very short time. Their practice is no different than what they do on site. For the clinical disciplines, it is different. I'm relying on someone else's physical examination. And for the bulk of my practice, it's a nurse practitioner. Although, depending upon the urgency of the consult, if we have a real sick patient, the referring doc will be present as well to facilitate the visit and also to carry the information back or to act on it quickly. So the physical examination is different. We've changed the paradigm. Even as an academic doctor, and I think there are times when I rely on other exams more just as part of the training process, but still, I always have that option to check myself. And you lose that with this, and that's a hurdle for a lot of clinicians to move through. I think one way we've addressed this, at least in my own practice, I have nurse practitioners that I work with, and we've become quite familiar with each other's practice. I have been out in the haze frequently. If I feel something abnormal on exam or hear something abnormal, I bring them on in and say, what do you think? And so I'm more comfortable with their skill level, and they're more comfortable with my practice approach. And it works, but it's about people. It's not about technology. It's about forming. I had the same situation to grapple with in my traditional clinic. When the nurse that I work with now came on board, I didn't know what her skill level was. She is superb. She's great at phone triage. She has a sixth sense. I didn't know that to begin with, and it took a while to build that. And telemedicine is no different. Camille Modis said this the other day, and it's so true. Her docs were saying, I don't have time to practice medicine. This is just something else that we're trying to fit into a busy day. Now, unless your system is really doc-friendly, and I'm not talking about pushing buttons, I'm talking about just physical location. The ideal scenario is walking out of one office, walking into another room with a telemedicine patient, back out of that room and into another room with an on-site patient. If it flows that way, your system's going to be used. Fortunately, at KU right now, we physically move ourselves out of the clinic and down the hall, and it's a 5-minute walk over to the telemedicine suite. We have a luxury that we can do that. My wife is in private practice. She sees 30 patients a day. She cannot leave 30 patients. Walk down the hall, get in her car, go 10 minutes to the telemedicine site, and then go back and try to finish your day. Your system is going to have to be user-friendly just by location. Also by buttons, don't get me wrong. I'm intimidated by a panel, so. And then you're working outside of a familiar system. I mean, all of us that are clinicians, we have clinics that we operate, that we run with, that we know everybody, they all know us, it works. Suddenly you pull a doc or a nurse out of their system and put them into a room with a technician, with clinicians in another part of the state that they don't know, and you're starting from ground zero. I do think we've seen a real cultural shift in the last 2 years. For 2 years, we've had many new projects come on board within the state. Our consultative services are increasing. The whole idea of telemedicine is no longer new. And it came because of phone calls. It came because of conversations that we had over lunch. It came because of the Kansas Medical Society newsletter. There's a little section in there now about telemedicine. Somebody writes something once a month about telemedicine. There is not a doc in the state right now that doesn't know about telemedicine, about both the KU project, but also what's going on in the community. That's different than it was 2 years ago. 2 years ago, we were saying, this is what it is, here's a monitor, here's a patient. We were really breaking it down. Doctors love the flexibility of working with specialists anywhere in the state or in the country or the world, right? Doesn't that make sense? I don't think so. We work with docs that we work with. We work with docs that we know. Those are going to be, hopefully, they're going to be nice to your patient when you refer them. If you get bad feedback, you don't refer them again. Those that you know are going to pick up the phone and say, we've got a big problem here that we have to deal with today. And those that are going to write a letter back to you so that when the patient shows up on your doorstep, you know what's going on. Telemedicine disrupts that tremendously. It's a hurdle. And I think the projects that are the most successful right now are those that have respected this and worked within this. You have a network in place already. It's very easy to make telemedicine fit the network. I don't think it's as easy to use telemedicine to establish a network. And there are a lot of consultants out there that will tell you this is the way to establish a network, you know, build yourself in the community, have more covered lives, get a foothold or whatever. But I don't think telemedicine will do that. I think you got to get out there and establish the network and make telemedicine fit it. I think the managed care systems have flourished, but they've already, that network's in place. The referral network is down. There's no obstructing or disrupting what is their typical referral. And if we look at the prison projects, very successful for the same reason. Every doc within the prison knows that list of docs that they're going to be referring to. And so it flows and it works. Oh, everybody says it's just the same, it's no different, what's the big deal, right? We still have a lot of reluctance with it. And I think the biggest reason that telemedicine is not like traditional practice is the lack of the hands-on. I mean, that just makes perfect sense to all of us, right? And because of that lack of hands-on, we all would like to find something in the literature, some study that says this is a reasonable way to do it, this is safe, you can practice good medicine this way. But it's not there yet. I think, again, Camille was saying, if you're going to go to the literature and convince your docs to come on because it's safe and we have good data to say that, it's not there yet. And it's a problem. How do you conduct these studies when a busy practice like mine sees 20 patients a month, 20 visits a month? Those of you that are physicians and nurses, you see 20 patients in an afternoon. Okay, so how do you conduct a study to really demonstrate efficacy? Last year in a magazine called Telemedicine Today, every year, which I think is actually a very reasonable magazine, every year they conduct a survey of active telemedicine programs. And last year, their survey, there are 5 sites that listed oncology. And I thought, great, I'll call these sites, we'll try to collaborate, we'll get our efficacy study off the ground, and then the strengthened study because there'll be more patients in other sites besides the cancer program. I called each one, and one site had seen 7 patients over a year, and most of the sites had seen 1 or 2. It's just not there yet. We just don't have a patient base to conduct the studies, and yet we don't want to develop the patient base until we get the studies. So it's a real catch. And for those of us that are enthusiasts, I want to say, oh, it's great, it's good practice this way, you should do it, but the academic part of me and the practitioner part of me still realizes we have a long way to go to demonstrate the safety of this, and that, yes, you can adequately diagnose. Doctors are afraid of a lawsuit resulting from telemedicine. You better believe it. I mean, this is always the first question I get. What about the liability issues? And how do you deal with the liability issues? I was unable to hear the lecture yesterday on the medical legal issues. Did he bring up any test cases so far? Because we're still waiting for the first clinical test case. I'm just hoping it's not me. Because we have no case law, and so it's really hard to figure how we're going to approach this and who's going to be responsible for what. I mean, there's so many more people to sue in this environment right now. I mean, it's not just the consultant oncologist at KU, there's a referring doc. Of course, they always get sued for the consultant does. But now now we have on-site nurse practitioners that we can bring into this. We have a telecom company. We can sue Vito. I mean, there are all these different people that we can spread the wealth around to. And we don't really have a test case to see who's going to be held responsible for what. I'm seeing a patient over the system and the line goes down. Should we sue the phone company? Who's responsible? And it's not there yet, although unfortunately I think we are going to have PIP data in another 5 years. It redefines standard of care in a sense. I've heard people argue you have to use telemedicine once it comes to your community because now you have access to specialists you didn't have before. And if you don't send a patient to a specialist by telemedicine, you're not practicing standard of care. There are many that believe telemedicine is going to basically encourage the national standard of care and that we all will be held to the same standards that we have in urban areas. But I also think the liability issues, when we think about them, let's think about what the issues are for traditional practice, because the reality is we're all afraid of being sued. Even every day, it's a part of the landscape of practice in medicine. When I started with this project, I went to our university attorneys and said, what are the legal issues here? Is this going to put me at greater risk? And they said two things. One, they said, what we would argue is that the standard of care you are practicing is that which is present in the community. So if I'm seeing a patient at Beloit, and there's no oncologist in Beloit, then I really need to practice the standard of care of the internist instead of the specialist, whatever that means. Okay? The other thing they told me is, we will make them demonstrate to us that you practice less than standard of care for other tele-oncologists in the country. And at that time, there weren't any other tele-oncologists in the country. And so they thought we would argue that there's no standard to hold me to. Well, frankly, neither one of those things made me feel particularly good. I mean, I'm not hearing the arguments that they're going to make when I get sued. I'm not hearing anything about what's the standard of care and what am I practicing. I wanted to be an A oncologist. I wanted to practice good care. I did not want to offer B services or C services. I think what we really need to do is shift the emphasis, if we can, away from this whole issue and get back into the efficacy study issues and making sure that we're practicing good medicine under the system. Telemedicine practice will not flourish until they're reimbursed by third-party payers. That's real interesting. This is always cited as a big barrier. And I think it does make sense for those that are in private practice. You're seeing 30 patients a day in your office already. I'm certainly not going to interrupt that whole process to go see a telemedicine patient that's going to take an hour out of my day and that I won't get reimbursed. So I think that is an issue that practitioners face. And I would leave you also with the fact we've got to think of other things that have to be reimbursed through this process. It's not just the healthcare provider, whether it's a nurse, clinician, or a physician. We also have telecom expenses. Some of our sites charge room fees. There are a whole lot of other expenses that go into this practice, and who's going to pay for that? I can assure you, HICPA is not going to pay for it. Most third-party payers aren't going to pay for it. They're going to want either the provider, because of the, quote, business they're getting from the system, to pay for it, or they're going to want the patient to. This is all a big issue because of the fee-for-service environment that many of us are still in or have been. I think when we get to a managed care type system, obviously this will become less of an issue. It certainly will from the healthcare provider's perspective. And then the real issue is, can you afford it? Can you afford the units and the telecom expenditure? I would encourage you all to think out of the box with regard to funding. Two of my practices now, two of the sites that I work, are partially funded by the local hospital. They feel they can justify paying part of my salary because they keep patients home. They generate chemotherapy fees locally. X-rays, labs stay locally. So you may want to look at alternative funding sources. It doesn't just have to be one or the other, fee-for-service or managed care.
I don't understand that. Say that again.
Two of the practices that I work one in Hayes and another one now in the north central part of the state. Besides offering consultative services statewide, but the formalized practices in which I see patients every Monday and every Thursday are partially funded by the hospital. Contractually, part of my salary is paid by that hospital. Why? Not because they can bill for my services over the system. They cannot, for the most part. At least they can't bill my HIPAA patients. They can bill third-party payers in Kansas, but not Medicare. The majority of my patients are Medicare. they give the chemotherapy locally with my oversight, so the chemotherapy fees stay local. That's one way they generate revenue. I also feel like they generate revenue because all the lab and x-rays stay local. The patient doesn't drive to Kansas City to see me now and get lab and x-ray at Katie Medical Center. They get that at home. And so the way they have justified paying part of my salary is the local fees that they do generate. So think about that when you go to different sites. There are other ways of generating dollars. What about the licensure issue? This is always, oh, geez, how many doesn't want to fuse because we have this archaic licensure system in the country. You have to be licensed in each state to practice. And it's true that, unfortunately, our telecom system doesn't understand the state boundary issues. And so you can see patients at a distance. I conducted one of my oncology clinics from Chicago for patients that were located in Kansas. Now, that was legal because I'm licensed to practice medicine in the state of Kansas. Kansas has also been considered really protectionist because they've passed the first legislation that said you can practice telemedicine in the state of Kansas, but you have to be licensed in the state to practice, or you have to have a consultation waiver, and we get the consultation exception. I don't really consider this that big an issue, and I'll tell you why. Because I practice. Because I realize that when I see patients in Hayes, Kansas, I'm practicing as a member of a team. Patients don't just come over to the telemedicine room and dial me up and we talk, and I work as the only provider that they see of me. I work with nurses, I work with referring docs. At 2 o'clock in the morning, when somebody comes into the ER with no white blood cells because of chemotherapy that I've given them, there better be a local healthcare system that can manage that acute problem. I really consider my services an adjunct to the care that's already performed locally. I'm not one that believes we're going to be dialing a doc. I just don't think we're there yet. I think we're going to be using this to work within health systems, not to be the health system. If any of you want to do consultative services for Kansans, all you have to do is call the State Board of Healing Arts and you can get a consultation exception form. It costs no money and you can do it. It is a way to track physicians that are providing the service. It isn't as protectionist as most people hear about when you go to telemedicine meetings. We are a more is better society, right? More is always better. More money, more car, more house. So more bandwidth should be better, right? The bigger bandwidth, the better off the telemedicine practice is going to be. I don't think so. I don't think I can work this. Okay. It's really very interesting, and at least for most of the projects in the States, we all started with high bandwidth options, and we seem to be moving down. Many of the first projects had full T1. Why? Because there's actually no motion artifact. The images were very clear. Everyone really liked it. The Europeans, the projects have been just the opposite. They started with low-end technology, and they build based on a particular need. And I have to give them this. I think that is a smart way to go. There's no reason to have a full T1 line to do clinical consultative services for oncology. I've been working at a quarter T1 for the last 2.5 years. Why? Because that's what they gave me to work with. It wasn't like it was this big, wild intellectual study that was randomized, prospective. We figured it all out. It was just they said, "Here, work at a quarter T1." That's what I got used to. Now, if you ask me to drop back to 128, I balk. I want to do 128. I'm used to a quarter T1. And when in reality, if I started with 128, I might be perfectly satisfied with that. And I guess what I would encourage you all to do is. I encourage you all just to keep an open mind about what your bandwidth options are. And we'll talk about it in a subsequent slide, but just keep an open mind. Come back to the technology several times before you make a decision. This is a classic. Physicians won't use this because they're afraid of it. Now, I don't really think that has been the case. There's no question, my first clinic or two, I was nervous, very nervous. Not so much because of the actual machine, but because I thought I was going to kill someone at a distance. That'll make you nervous. So I do think there is that initial period of anxiety, and I think I didn't really have a Gary Doolittle to talk to. We were just kind of thrown in there. now I work with the docs as they come on board. I don't think their anxiety level is so great. I don't think it's an issue. I do think that first consult is a hurdle to get over, but after that, I don't think we're dealing with that as a big problem. I do think technical support people should be there. I hardly know how to turn this equipment on, and I cannot troubleshoot this equipment. I don't want to troubleshoot this equipment. It's a problem. I'm going to go dictate, will you please page me when you've got it running? So I'm a big believer in the technical support. And I would tell you that most of our practitioners have adapted very quickly to the technology. Once you get them in the door, they'll adapt quickly.
Jim, what was your comment about age-related?
I don't think it's age-related. I've heard comments that docs that have white hair won't like it. I thought it was funny until I started noticing all these white hairs, and I don't think it's as funny anymore. I don't think it's age-related at all. I think it's user-friendly related. If I walk in there and you're having trouble with the system, I really don't want to sit there for 15 minutes while you troubleshoot and get it going. I really do want to go do something else and let me know. And I don't want to give you the wrong idea, because in the 370 consults we've done right now, we haven't been able to get the system up three times, and the system's gone down once. So it's not a real common problem. I'm just telling you that as long as you make it user-friendly and put it in a location where the doc can go, I don't think you're going to see this fear of the technology. And I also think it helps to have a clinician that's already been using the system that introduces new docs on board. I do think that helps. As far as the bandwidth selection, again, really keep an open mind, look at the service you're trying to provide, and make the technology fit the application. I just can't overemphasize that. What about acceptance? Let me go quickly, June. Okay. I think for the most part, patients do like telemedicine. I don't think all the questions have been answered by far. And I've been at this now long enough to realize that some refuse to use the system. Okay? And again, I don't think it's age-related. I have 6 patients right now from the Hayes practice that have never been seen over the system and will not. We've been trying to get at the reason why. And they're all in their 30s, a couple in their 40s, one in 50s. 96-year-old women come in and grab the microphone and go for it. It's not age-related. We're trying to tease that out, but when you go to conferences and they say everybody loves it, I don't think that's necessarily true. I think with time, we're going to see a population that doesn't. Do I think my kids will love it? Yeah. Do I think they'll be afraid of it? No. But for now, if you have some patients that say, I'm really not interested, I don't want to do it, don't be surprised. It can happen. Also, when you ask them, do they like it, it's compared to what? If I'm out in Hayes, my patients really like to see me in person. If I'm in Kansas City and they have to drive 5 hours, I can assure you they don't think I'm worth it. So it really is, when you design your studies and you're looking at satisfaction, it's compared to what? I like seeing you over the system compared to driving 2 hours to see you. When we look at provider satisfaction, I would encourage you to look at two perspectives, not just those that are providing the service of the system, but those that are referring to the system. And that has never been studied, to my knowledge. And the reason I'm so interested in this, there are groups of physicians in the state that will refer to me over the system as a second visit. They want the patient to meet me in person first, and then they'll refer for follow-up. But they don't want to refer for a first-time visit. And I think that's a real interesting thing, because to me, you can do first-time consults over the system as well as follow-ups. Telemedicine's cost effective? I don't think so. We've been doing some cost tracking data, and even for a practice like the tele-oncology system, it's still quite expensive to see a patient in this manner. I think it's important to do these studies so that we can figure out how to utilize the system more efficiently so it does become a reasonable cost effective service. And also I would tell you that it's very difficult to do. When I was looking at the cost data for the oncology practice, I tried to figure out or find cost data for traditional oncology practice. It's not out there. It certainly isn't out there in the published literature. And if you go to the private sector, this is not information they necessarily want to share with somebody that they could consider their competition, so it's considered proprietary. So it's really hard to figure out what does it cost to run an oncology practice. What does it cost to see a patient every day in your office? It's really hard to get at those data.
I'm not sure the insurers do.
Well, they have some sense, whether it's
very gross, maybe.
I think it probably is insurer or company dependent. My wife is medical director for one of our insurance companies in the Kansas City area, and she was appalled at what they don't know. She also was impressed that they knew a lot more than practitioners did at this time, what it costs to run a practice. So that's part of what I think we all need to be dealing with just in healthcare in general. Go on. Last, I just think it's really important that we focus on the research end of this. And it's not just because I'm an academic doc. I think if we could answer these questions through rigorous research, I think we would see this technology adopted and diffused much more rapidly than it has been today. I won't go through the top 10 worst reasons to start a telemedicine practice, but I always wanted to be on TV. That was the one that got me in. Thank you very much.
Thank you.